Today on Doomed! You're likely familiar with Facebook and Google and other household tech names that collect your online data. But there are tons of companies you've never heard of sucking up what you do on the internet and using that data to help some of the worst online to monetize their content. And now, those very same companies may soon enable law enforcement and others to spy on you in a post-Roe America. If it sounds horrible, that's because you're listening to Doomed with Matt Binder, everybody. That's right. And joining me today to discuss all of this, let me bring us up on the feed here. She's the co-founder of Check My Ads and former co-founder of Sleeping Giants, Nandini Jami. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Hi, Matt. Thanks so much for having me.
It is a pleasure. I've been following your work on Check My Ads for a while, and I want people to know, before we sort of delve into any of the specific campaigns you guys have rolled out, I want people to understand what Check My Ads is and what you all do over there. So really quickly, can you break down what is Check My Ads?
That's a great question. Check My Ads, we are the first and only ad tech watchdog. And our current mission is to dismantle the disinformation economy. So when I say watchdog, when I talk about ad tech, I want to talk about the disinformation economy in general. As you sort of set this up, this goes beyond Facebook and Twitter and the YouTube and all that stuff that we're usually talking about. That is where disinformation operatives amplify their message. But when it comes to where they make money, where they cash out, that actually doesn't happen on those platforms. That's where like Facebook makes money off of them. But for them to make money, they need to move the audience to their own websites and to their own properties. And that's where there's thousands of ad tech companies on the other end of that that are ready to plaster those websites in display ads and video ads and all kinds of garbage that makes your computer move slower. And that is where they make the bulk of their revenues. So that is what we focus on researching, and that is what we and that is where we cut them off. The disinformation economy to us is advertisers spend around something between, and we don't even know the answer, because that's how opaque this industry is. Anywhere between like $400 to $700 billion a year. And much of the way that this money is spent from the point that it leaves the advertiser's wallet to wherever it ends up in the whoever's bank account it ends up in the world is a mystery. And sometimes, most of the time, we don't know where that money goes. So that's what we do at Check My Ads. We track these things down and we focus on holding ad tech companies accountable rather than the people themselves.
Right. So you know, when you say disinformation economy, you're basically talking about these companies that are making money by placing ads on websites that basically get all their traffic from content that spreads falsehoods and in some instances, even, you know, far right extremist or reactionary content.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this is something that we discovered in 2016. We found advertisers, big advertisers, having their ads run on Breitbart. And that was the first time that anyone realized that their ads could end up in corners of the, you know, these sort of dark corners of the internet. But Breitbart was just one website. So while we were able to successfully demonetized Breitbart that to the tune of like 90% of its ad revenues within the first 3 months, that was a drop in the bucket. There's thousands of more websites, and there's all kinds of ways that the bad guys are sort of funneling money to their bank accounts. And because the ad tech supply chain is so opaque, there is like, it's like the perfect place to do it.
Right. So basically, I want people to really understand, because if they're not so tech savvy, they're hearing us say ad tech and help monetize these sites. So basically, what we're talking about is there are companies who, you know, everyone I think is familiar at some point, at some level, I would say, I guess, with Google Ads. They see them on websites. They know that if they click, that website makes money. Basically, there are thousands of companies that run similar types of contextual advertising on a whole range of websites. And obviously, it broadens out into like banner ads, you know, actual advertisements with graphics, some of them video ads, I'm sure. And yeah, these are companies that usually sometimes, actually, from what I understand, they pay a lot more than Google Ads. Obviously, I've also heard that they have a much higher bar in terms of the traffic a website needs to be bringing in for them to be accepted into these programs. But some of these sites, these lesser known ad tech companies, I should say, pay a lot out to these sites. Is that true?
Yeah. It's so for the less ad tech savvy, when I talk about ad exchanges and ad tech, the biggest ad exchange in the world is Google. It's like they run like 95% of the ads that you see on the internet. And the rest of them are sort of smaller players, but they do the same thing. And they, so that's sort of the meeting place for publishers and advertisers. So advertisers, they represent the demand, and the publishers are the supply. So basically what's happening in the ad tech supply chain, when I refer to this, is so there's like an ad exchange in the middle, and this is where they connect. But then there's all these, and like that's like the most important thing to know. But then there's all these other companies over time that have sort of inserted themselves into the process. So now it's like, okay, so like whereas you, in the newspaper days, you would have gone to a newspaper and placed your ad directly on the newspaper, you know, call up the newspaper and be like, hey, I want my ad in the style section. What happens today is you go to the really big companies will go to, say, an agency, and then the agency will go to a set of ad networks and ad exchanges. And then there's all these companies that come in and say, we can help you optimize, we can help you target. And so there's all these players that are sort of like inserting themselves into the process, taking a cut of the ad revenues, and really sort of like everyone just kind of takes their commission, and the publisher actually in many cases doesn't end up with as much money as you would think, but they essentially make it so difficult for an advertiser to understand where their ads actually were placed. How much money are they spending versus how much do they need to spend? And the advertiser usually just ends up with a high level report of, you know, like overall impressions, like total impressions, total conversions, total clicks, but they rarely know what is happening under that. And that's the important stuff, because that's like the URL that your ad appeared on is a very, very important detail. But most advertisers don't ever see that, because they've handed over essentially their ad spend. And some of these companies are like, these Fortune 500 companies are spending a pretty penny, and they don't have a clue where their ads were placed.
So these companies are basically, for viewers, I want to again make it absolutely clear, some of this gets confusing for if you're not familiar with the space. These companies basically trust these ad tech companies to place their advertisements on the network of websites that these ad tech companies have basically compiled. Like they've reached out to various different websites, said, we want you on our network, and these large brands pay that ad tech company for their ads to appear across the network. And a lot of times what you're saying is the brands do not even know the exact websites which are part of this network that their ads are appearing on.
Yep. It sounds crazy, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's not just the exchanges, right? Like there's what has happened over the past 10, 15 years is that advertisers have effectively lost control of where their ads are placed. So yeah, so they don't place the ads, it's happening programmatically, and then it's happening through a third party that is essentially hiding the information, like the very critical information of where those ads were placed and, you know, other like other important details from the client. So the advertiser today only knows like the average advertiser. And then I totally forgot to mention that there's been this huge sort of like industry-wide campaign to convince advertisers not to look at their own ads. Like, don't worry about it. We're taking care of it. So when advertisers first found their ads on Breitbart, they all, you know, flipped out and they wanted answers. And so what happened as a response from the industry was there was all these brand safety technology companies whose job it was to keep your ads off of Breitbart coming up with all sorts of like new technologies to keep your ads away from hate speech and violence and inappropriate content. But all they did was provide another layer of like just another layer of obscurity so that the advertiser now doesn't know where their ads are being placed versus being blocked. So what they did instead of like, I don't know, giving what the industry did instead of giving advertisers the tools to check their ads was to introduce another tool that would where they sort of like tick off boxes saying, hey, I don't want to be on violent content. I don't want to be this is my risk threshold for being on like sexuality and just like all kinds of weirdo like categories that like no one understands. Like even I, like if you or I had to look at this and had to like define what is like medium or low risk violence, like what does that even mean? But those are the kinds of buttons that they give them, the sort of toggles they give them. And then they place the ads for them and they never let them see what actually happened. There's no way to audit it.
Right. I mean, I'm sure there was some. I'm not familiar with the advertising industry in media, like old school, like legacy media, like TV or radio. But I'm sure there was something sort of similar back when that was the major, you know, before the internet era, where I'm sure like local radio stations and local TV stations sort of ran like a network, you know, said, oh, you will run your, we could run your ads on our network of stations. But like then, like, you know, the worst sort of content you could go on, I guess, would be like what? Like your ad plays during like an R-rated movie on some local TV station. Like it seems like the bar for the type of problematic content your ads can be run next to you or during is a lot higher during the, you know, in the internet era where anyone can basically make a website, drive some traffic to it, and get brought on to one of these networks, and these brands have no idea where that's going.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, at least there's like the FCC for TV, and it was never automated to this level. I mean, there was never this many players in the supply chain. I mean, there's companies that I've been studying this for like 2-3 years now. That's all I do, and I still don't know what half these companies do. And there's people who've worked in this industry their entire careers who, you know, I'll go to them with this company I've heard of, and they're like, I have no idea what it does. It's twisted itself into a pretzel. It makes no sense to anybody, and it's just this gigantic, like, defective, powerful machine that controls everything that we see and do. Because and one thing that I want to introduce as a sort of the other side of this, when we talk about the disinformation economy, when I talk about these companies that are sort of deciding, these brand safety companies, you know, coming into the picture and saying we will block your ads from inappropriate content, what that actually means is that these companies are deciding how $400 billion are spent across the internet. They are essentially shaping the information ecosystem, and their algorithms are completely under wraps, a total black box, and no one even knows they exist, not even the publishers.
Right. And it is, there is something
Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry, you cut out for a second there. What is that you said?
Oh, sorry. I meant no one knows they exist, and publishers can't even get access or any insights into these algorithms.
Right. I mean, to me, like a very concerning part of it, and part of, when I see activist organizations or tech accountability groups go after a tech firm or company, I'm 9 times out of 10 familiar with who they're going after. I would even say probably even more than 9 times out of 10. But with Check My Ads, a lot of times I see the companies you guys are putting on blast and trying to get to hold accountable. And I'm like, who are these guys? And I think that's something that makes this even more concerning. You know, whatever we think about Facebook and Google and Twitter and TikTok, all of these forward-facing, like, consumer brand names, there is some accountability there. As bad as they are, their names are known, and people know who to point the finger at when their product does something wrong. Or in their case, sometimes right, but shouldn't be doing it. Right for them, but they shouldn't be doing it. But here, these companies seem to be able to run completely under the radar. No one knows who they are. No one knows who to go after. A lot of these ad networks, even on those websites that are their partner, that their ads are running on, they don't you'll see the the website because you're on it. You know the advertiser because you see their ad. They don't the middleman, though, the ad tech company, they don't advertise their name. Usually, some of them actually like to put powered by or whatever, but that's rare. Usually, these guys are completely hidden in the shadows while, you know, being the middleman and serving the ad to that website.
That's right. And every day I learn about some new random ass company, and it's terrifying. And a lot of these companies are shell corporations, like zero ownership details. I mean, the advertising industry is like, it's like a money launderer's paradise, because you can, everything that you said is possible, and they can access these multi-million dollar budgets from Fortune 500, absolutely no handle on, you know, or understanding of where their money is going. And it's just a cash grab.
Right.
It's just a cash grab. And I mean, the extent to which this is just, I mean, from an advertiser's perspective, it's a nightmare, because I mean, just real quick, one of the sort of, I guess, more interesting stories from my time at Sleeping Giants was, we really hit Uber hard when they, because they were still advertising on Breitbart. We went after them for quite a while, back in 2017, I think it was. And, what's his name? The CEO, Travis, he was like, okay, fine. Just shut it. Like shut down the Breitbart ads, the ads on Breitbart. And, so that's what they did. The paid acquisitions team instructed all of their vendors to block Breitbart from their media buy, but ads kept slipping through. So, cause like we were all watching it, right? Like our followers, we're all going to Breitbart. We're still seeing Uber ads. So they're like, why are these ads still appearing on this website when we explicitly told everyone not to do it? And so the head of performance, the head of acquisition went and sort of, and dug in to see what was going on. Stopped, paused all of the campaigns that were, all of the vendors that were working, that were placing ads on Breitbart. So paused them. He was like, this is going to be a big deal because we just paused 10% of our ad spend, which is huge for a company like Uber, which is going head to head with Lyft. And so he braced for this big drop in new app downloads. But that is not what happened. What ended up happening was nothing changed. And this is a company, like 10% of this company's budget is like an enormous amount of money. So it was kind of weird, right? Like they're still spending money, but they're not seeing any results. So then he goes in and he, you know, digs around to see what was happening, comes out realizing that they had been defrauded something like $60 million. Keeps digging, finds out they've been defrauded like $100 million. And their ad budget was $150 million. So like 2/3 of their ad budget was like nothing. Like it was not contributing to their business at all. They just burned through $100 million.
Wow. Wow. That's
And that's Uber.
Right. One company.
Think about questions for the entire economy. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And
oh, no, no. There were multiple companies doing the fraud. But yeah, that like Uber was being defrauded by that much. And they had the resources to catch things like this. I mean, think about what's happening to all the other companies.
Wait,
if Uber can't catch this.
So what was happening? They were basically, I want to make sure I understand then. So they were paying like an ad tech company to run these ads, and they didn't realize how much of their ad spend was, like, they changed their ad spend or something. What happened there?
Okay, so this is going to get like a tiny bit technical, but okay. So there was multiple kinds of ad frauds that were happening. This was attribution fraud. So what was happening was they went to this company. I think the company is called Fetch, and it is a subsidiary of a company called Dentsu. By the way, the advertising agency like conglomerate situation is insane. There's like so many names to go around, but anyway, this company called Fetch. So they had this like strategy where they were, you know, like all those useless apps, like calculator apps and things like that. So they were, right. they had flooded the market with those apps, like the app store markets. And so people were downloading, say, let's say like the calculator app. And so what this app was programmed to do was when someone who has that app on their phone searches for Uber in the app store, so types in U-B-E-R, this pixel fires. Like the app fires a pixel, and then it takes credit for the download. So no, the user was not being served Uber ad. Like what Uber thought happened was that people were clicking on Uber ads and then they were downloading Uber. That's not what was happening. They were learning about Uber from other places, you know, like through TV ads or whatever. Maybe they'd seen ads before or whatever, but they themselves went in and they typed in Uber. And this company was taking credit for it. I mean, it was just straight fraud.
Wow.
And that was one of the, like, I think someone else was just, like, one of the other companies was just, like, doctoring Excel spreadsheets and just, like, straight up lying. Like, it was just really, yeah, and this is all because advertisers are not checking their ads, which is why we started first a company called Check My Ads and then a nonprofit called Check My Ads Institute.
I gotta say, I have another podcast, another show called Scam Economy, and you could have come on that one and told that story.
I was thinking that too. I was like, "You want to hear scams? I got."
That's. I didn't want to get it too off, but that was an interesting story for sure. So, let's get a little bit back on track now, and we're gonna have to. I might have to actually ask you to come on the other show now that I heard that one. Yeah. Let's talk about now, because one of the ways a lot of these ad tech companies make money isn't just on the advertising itself, but also on the data that it collects from people that it then packages up and sells to people or organizations or companies that want to basically mine and, you know, use that data to do who knows what. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. I can. The promise of digital advertising and the reason that everyone bought into it 15 years ago was the idea of serving the right person with the right message at the right time. The biggest pain point for marketers and advertisers pre-programmatic advertising was there's like this quote that the marketers love to say, you know, like one guy actually said it, 50% of my, or half my ad spend is wasted. I just don't know which half. And that was the idea that like you put up a billboard and you pay for it, but you never know if the billboard actually worked or not. So when this like concept of like, I can track my advertising, I can track if people are clicking and seeing my ads, when that sort of was presented to them, obviously everyone got excited and bought into it. But what happened was sort of a race to the bottom, I guess. I don't know. I don't know that that's the right way to put it, but like this sort of this ideal of being able to reach the right person meant that you needed to know more about the person. So that sort of has driven this economy of like of data brokers and of like tracking and monitoring and understanding people in ways that are increasingly invasive and inappropriate. And so, yeah, today, there's apps that are tracking where you are right now. They track where you go during the day, like as long as you have a smartphone and it's connected to your data source, they're tracking where you go. And that is how all these apps that you use for free and even pay for provide their service to you. So when you pay even like the, I don't know, $5 a month or whatever that you pay for, I don't know, your meditation app, that's not where they're making most of their money. They're making most of their money by following you around and selling that data to data brokers. And then the data brokers repackage it up in all kinds of ways. And they make it what they're basically trying to get at is they're merging enough data that they can basically figure out exactly who you are. And I mean, I remember when I was a sort of new marketer, like back in 2014, and I thought it was so exciting that I could track and, you know, like see what my customers were doing, because that would help me formulate better campaigns, maybe write better copy, just get to know my customer better. But the amount of information that they have about you now, like literally your periods, like that is like what marketer actually needs that data? And no one has really stopped to ask in this industry, do we actually need to know all this shit about people? Because I don't think you need that to sell toothbrushes.
Right. You're talking about like those apps that literally help women track their periods, and that data is actually not just sitting on your phone. It actually gets sent out to the app company and whoever they work with, their partners that package and sell that data.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And right. This data is being used in such horrifying ways. If I may, I just remembered there was a film that I. A documentary that came out just before the elections called People, what was it called? People You May Know, I think. And that documentary was sort of takes you into this dark underbelly of apps that are collecting collecting data on people's emotional health, identifying who is depressed, who is emotionally vulnerable, who's just gotten a divorce, who has a lot of anxiety, and they were collecting that information, repackaging it up, and selling it specifically to political parties, specifically to one political party.
Wonder which one that is. Oh, ho, ho.
Yeah, and that's legal.
Right.
So they collect all kinds of, I mean, when you like, be really careful when you download a meditation app or anything where you are communicating your mental health to somebody because that paints a picture of who you are.
Right.
And that helps, that is exactly the kind of thing that marketers don't need, and there's no reason to collect it. But some people in politics, maybe working on collecting that information for other reasons.
Right. And we're going to get to that in just one second. But I just wanted to sort of point out, I think people can really get a handle on just how big of a business the data collection side of this is. By just, they might have even heard of this. It's probably one of the more mainstream stories that you would hear about when it comes to packages and selling data, or how important data is to these companies in general. You might have heard that Facebook recently, I think it was like the past quarterly or the one before that, they actually lost a lot of money or were projecting a loss of a lot of money, because in a rare good move from one of these big tech companies, Apple was going to allow, and you probably notice it now when you download a new app, Apple now asks its users, iPhone users, when you download an app that collects your location data, or your data in any way, really, Apple actually says, do you want to provide this app with that data? Yes or no? And users can now say, no, we don't want to give this data to this app that I just downloaded. And Facebook projected that that one question Apple now asked was going to cause them big losses. And they actually, their stock fell. They were projecting less revenue. So really, this is really big business, and I think that story is the perfect example. And it's a rare time when we're talking about companies that people have actually heard of. Like, this is Facebook, who is doing that with your data. Who knows what some of these lesser-known companies are still doing or going to do or are doing right now or doing. And that brings us to what you were mentioning. Last week, and you have an interesting story that I think really ties it all. It's a great segue. Last week there was that leak from the Supreme Court that basically it seems like, unless there is some change, but it seems like we are headed to an America, we're going to live in an America where Roe v. Wade is no longer the law of the land. States will be allowed to completely and entirely make abortion illegal and pass laws that punish abortion providers, doctors, women who seek abortions, people who help people get abortions. Really a giant attack on women's reproductive rights, women's rights in general, the pro-choice movement. It's as horrifying as it all is, it could get even worse due to everything we just spoke about. Why don't you tell us about that? But first, actually, where were you when this news broke, I should say?
I was in the jungle in Mexico trying to have 1 week of peace and quiet. And I had like went off Twitter for the week. Then I got the notification about the abortion news, and I think I came across this article. It was the one by Joseph Cox at Vice, a very, very critical, important article. I'm so glad he wrote it, because I read that and I was like, SafeGraph, where have I heard this before? SafeGraph is the new company of a relatively new, in the sense, in ad tech terms, the same man who founded the company, another company called LiveRamp. And that's also a pretty sketchy, like, stalkery company as well. So I had come across that company before. I'd come across Orrin Hoffman before in my research. And I was like, he's at it again. The thing about my work is that it's very easy for these sort of companies to hide behind their company names and obscure language and all that kind of stuff to kind of confuse people about what's really going on. So I think it's really important to point out who the people are, like faces. Like, these are their individual people in this industry that are making these decisions to do these things and to profit off of them. And so my first reaction was to make this thread of individual, first Orrin, who founded this company, and the individuals who had given him money to do it. And the very mission of this company is to democratize data. He wants to put data, our physical locations in the hands of anyone who pays him to do it, pays him for it. Right.
And I think people need to understand, like, we're not talking like, you know, people might be thinking, okay, like, they sell this data for what? Hundreds of thousands of people, data on 100,000 people must cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. But from my understanding, a lot of these companies package data in all sorts of different ways based on demographics, based on niches, like, you know, what kind of websites they were pulled off of or what industries would possibly be interested in this data. And sure, some of this data is probably sells for a lot of money and maybe only moneyed corporations would be interested. But then a lot of this data is also very accessible. You could buy this user data for a couple hundred bucks. And on top of that, when we're talking like law enforcement or other government agencies, price probably won't really be an issue at all. If we're, you know, if a law enforcement agency in a red state decides to track people who are seeking out an abortion, going to these data brokers seems like a very easy way, regardless of whatever the cost is, to sort of see, hey, the people in this general area in this state, they've been searching for this. They've been, you know, and you could see everywhere they went. So you could probably easily narrow down if you really want to. Oh, this person went to this office and then checked out on this app, this information, and then they went to this address, which is probably this person's home. I'm pretty sure the place they went before that was their office. We know who they are pretty much. So, I mean, it seems like this is all going to be a real problem. And correct me if I'm wrong about anything I just laid out there.
No, that's entirely correct. And you don't need that much information. Like you don't need that many data points. You need, like, for most of these cases, if you want to figure something out about someone or where they live or who they are is where do they go at night and where do they go in the morning? Because they sleep in their house at night and then they go to work. And there's only so many people who live in your house and go to that place for work. So, that's what makes it so scary.
Right. Oh my God. Like it's, you know, and so what happened with this company specifically, the Safeguard, you said they were called, right?
Safeguard.
Safeguard. I think that's like a VPN company or something like that. The name sounds familiar. Like I must've said it for some reason. What did Safeguard end up? Because I know you, really in a really viral series of tweets, really, and good for you, really called them out, put them on blast. And, you know, because at one point, I think you even found out some of the, like some of their investors and even tagged them on it. And they had to come out and make it clear in documents that they, you know, the old Apple Notes apology. They had to make it clear that they support women's rights. Yeah. They
strongly support women. That is why I'm an investor in Safeguard. Yes. So the reason that, to put it delicately, people in ad tech don't like Check My Ads Institute is because we go there. We call people out. And no one has ever done that because no one knows what they do. They've just gotten away with their bullshit for so long because, and even I was intimidated when I first sort of entered this industry and I felt like there was stuff that I was supposed to know as a marketer. They hide behind this jargon. They hide behind this, oh, you're not smart enough. You don't know this like we do because we're experts. And there's all these words that the jargon and the words and the acronyms and all that stuff. But that is all smoke and mirrors. And so when you see, when you see, for example, Oren in his reply to me saying something like, we do not collect, I don't remember what he said, but it was a lie. I mean, it was like, we do not collect information on individual users, or we don't collect identities. That's a bald-faced lie. I put them on blast for that reason. I wanted the pressure to be on these individuals who know very well and understand very well what they invested in, and sort of force them to experience the consequences of that. When the public understands what they understand what they do, and they were okay with investing in it. So now I want the public to understand what they do and you know, let them know what they think about that. One investor pulled out. One investor sold his shares and donated it to Planned Parenthood. Another investor told me that he supports women and made a whole newsletter update to his audience. And he said, read these articles about, he's like, I also think it's a big problem that people are, that data is so easy to get your hands on. Read these articles to learn more. Like until you divest, until you sell your shares and you are like completely pulled out and you've cut ties, I don't want to hear about it.
Right. So this you know, this is I guess we'll have to see going forward what other, I mean, I'm sure Check My Ads will be on top of other companies that do similar sort of practices, if, you know, as you know, this is really something that I feel like while it's still up in the air, but it pretty much feels like it's going that way, obviously, if you just look at the Supreme Court and who's, you know, who's deciding here. But, you know, and I guess until it's done, it's still, I don't know, John Roberts says he's still working on it, trying to, who knows, who knows? Yeah.
Those things are out of our control right now, but the thing that is in our control is this work. And that's why... Yes. We do it every day. I mean, it's almost, I don't want to say it's like therapy. It's just something, but it is something that I do every day because because it makes a difference and I can see the change taking place in front of my eyes. I see it happening over and over again. The people who we target are scared of us because they know that we're onto them and that we understand the game they're playing. And we know how to cut them off from their most important and unlimited source of revenue.
So let's talk about, I want to hear, because I want to get into this. This is recent, and I know you over at Check My Ads have been on these guys, and I'm talking about Human Events and Postmillennial. Excuse me, sorry. And I got to say, people who work for those two sites are, I guess you can say, series regulars here on Doomed. Ian Miles Chong, Andy Ngo, some of our faves over here on this show. I have a long history with some of them too. But before we get to that, I want to ask you, what are some of the biggest sort of, you know, success stories with you? You know, you were talking about how recently you got Safegraph to do some changes. We're still not sure how much, but you know, you definitely had an effect. What are some of the big, like, you guys have stopped some advertising on some pretty big right wing websites and disinfo disseminators.
Yeah, I just wanna clarify that the Safegraph thing is not like currently part of our mission. It was just something that I did. And I'm like really pleased with, at least that there was some immediate outcome. And what happened is that Safegraph ended up, announcing that they would no longer collect data on family planning clinics, and they're removing it from their self-serve product, which is like the thing that anyone can sign up to, and their API, which, effectively, in theory, cuts off people from being able to track folks coming in and out of family planning centers and Planned Parenthood. But what we do focus on,
I just want to point out, that's what you were able to do when you were just winging it. So let's hear what you guys do when it's actually part of
It's been a busy few years. last year, so basically what happened last year was we started looking at the postmillennial, and we've long moved away from talking to advertisers because advertisers generally, like I just said, they don't know where their ads are going. They're not in control. The people who are in control are the ad exchanges. So we go to them, and all these ad exchanges have supply policies. So if you Google's publisher policy, you'll see there's a whole bunch of things that they promise advertisers that they will not monetize. Like, we will not place your ads on derogatory content, content that incites harassment and abuse and so on, and violence and all those kind of things. And So I started taking this information to ad exchanges, and I'm not like sitting here saying I think it is my personal opinion that, you know, like you shouldn't be advertising on the post-millennial. I'm saying this is the content that you're monetizing, and this is the supply policy that you yourself have put out for yourself. This is your standards that you wrote, and it is your legal agreement with advertisers to enforce it. And so the ad exchanges started dropping them one by one. Now, when an ad exchange drops you, you lose access to thousands of advertisers at once. That's why we don't mess with advertisers anymore. That's not worth the effort. Ad exchanges are where it's at. So when you have less advertisers or less ad exchanges working with you, then you have less competition for that space on your website. So your CPM or your cost per mil, the total cost per 1,000 impressions goes down. So you start losing like shit tons of revenue. And so we started to work on, we were doing that. And then Dan Bongino like inserted himself into this situation and started to harass me on Twitter. He started talking about me on his podcast, basically doing exactly like violating the supply policy of every ad exchange. So I let him do it. And then I took all that behavior, recorded it, documented it, and I sent it to the ad exchanges. The post-millennial and Dan Bongino both lost like over half a dozen ad exchanges, a bunch of companies you haven't heard of that were just like basically sending them cash payouts every couple weeks. And Bongino, I mean, you never know what's happening at these big ad tech companies, especially Google. But Google stepped in one day and they suspended him from YouTube, and then he evaded his ban a couple of days or a week later, and so they permanently suspend the like permaban him.
Right.
And Google, like YouTube is Google, and Google Ads are also Google. So if you are going to suspend him and terminate him from one platform, why wouldn't you do it for the other? So that's what we said. And so the next day, Google killed the ads on Bongino.com, but he also runs BonginoReport.com. And so what they did was they announced that they would not be silenced and by Google, and they canceled their own Google ads from BonginoReport.com. It was so funny. Bongino doesn't have Google Ads anymore. He does not make money on his website anymore. How much money did he lose is a question that a lot of people have asked. And because, again, the advertising technology supply chain is so opaque, I cannot tell you the answer to that with certainty. But what I can extrapolate based on the fact that Breitbart was making $8 million in or expected to make $8 million off of ad revenues in 2017 and then lost 90% of it because of our efforts. The fact that Gateway Pundit made $1.1 million in the election year, this past election year, from Google alone. I also got Gateway Pundit kicked off of like three other ad exchanges before that. And they were making additional revenue from that. I'm going to guess, because Dan Bongino is like, his Facebook page, the thing that drives so much traffic to his website was a regular Facebook top 10 page. I'm guessing that he lost several million dollars.
It's got to be a lot, right? Yeah. And people really need to understand, like, when you see those, you know, that top 10 Facebook pages every day, that gets, you know, there's that Twitter account that says which page has got the most engagement and views. Like it's bad they're disseminating this stuff, obviously, and that it's getting so much interaction on Facebook. But the reason at least they're doing it is because there's money to be made from doing it. And so when you see that top 10 list, it's not just like, oh, all those people read it on Facebook. It's, oh my God, those top 10 pages are making a killing sending all those people to their website, because that's what those top posts are. Like the posts that are ranking, that are putting them on that top 10, those are never just like random statements on Facebook that don't lead anywhere, or they're rarely ever just like a photo meme or a video uploaded to Facebook. No, like 99.9% of the time, those posts that get all that interaction are forwarding people to their website. And why would they want to do that? Why wouldn't they want to get that information to people directly, easily, just on their feed? Because they want people to click through so they get ad revenue.
You got it. That's the game. And Bongino was the biggest success for us. I sort of joke that he demonetized, he like canceled himself. Thank you for that, Dan. but also we launched the J6 insurrectionists campaign on January 5th of this year, nearly one year after the big event. And we picked out 6 of the biggest voices in disinformation. I always forget one, and I pulled it up on a tab here so I don't forget. We picked out Steve Bannon, Dan Bongino, Glenn Beck, Charlie Kirk. Where's the thing when you need it? I get so nervous with this list. Anyway, so we picked out those 6 and Tim Pool, a couple others. I don't know how many I've gotten you so far, but if I haven't sent Glenn Beck, he's another. I think that makes 6. Glenn Beck has lost multiple ad exchanges. Charlie Kirk, his website full of ads one day. A week after we write about him, the ads are all gone. It was all being processed through a company you've never heard of called Playwire. Playwire was also working with Human Events. That disappeared as well. Steve Bannon, we've been working on him for the past couple of weeks. He's hosted by Real America's Voice, which is owned by a company called Performance One Media LLC. And Performance One Media LLC also runs weathernation.tv. And so they push weathernation.tv to all the ad exchanges and to all the advertising agencies, knowing that no one is going to dig in and look to see like what else is there. And so they push that forward, and then they subsidize, we believe, I have to say that legally, they subsidize War Room through Weather Nation. So they've found really creative ways to continue making money, knowing that this brand safe content, the stuff that won't get blocked by brand safety companies and won't get, these advertisers are just looking for the bad words, right? Like they don't, some of them want to just avoid, like negative, anything that sort of like they view as negative or controversial, but no one is going to find the weather to be controversial. So they make money doing, just talking about the weather, and so we've adjusted our own strategy accordingly. So we're asking ad exchanges to remove the entire account associated with Performance One Media LLC, and we've had several ad exchanges do that as well. And this really is the most effective way to really mess up their growth strategies. I mean, the Post Millennial just announced last week that they are merging or being acquired by Human Events Media Group. That means the Post Millennial is now a part of a white nationalist affiliated media organization. That is the information that ad exchanges need to drop the entire thing from their inventory. And that is what we're going to be working on in the next few days and weeks. And we are planning a really, really exciting and interesting campaign for I'm just going to say the near future. It is everything that we've done, but turbocharged. And I wish I could tell you what it is. I'm so excited about it.
Oh, you're not going to give a hint.
Sorry, not today. But you can follow along on, and here's my little plug, checkmyads.org/branded, sign up for our newsletter. That's where we hold our feet to the fire. That's where we put out the sort of investigations and reports that we're doing. And they're fun to read, if I do say so myself. We try to keep it light around here. Ad tech and disinformation isn't the most fun or interesting thing out there. So we really focus on making it accessible to the average person. And our J6 campaign enabled the public to come in and start writing emails. And by writing, don't worry about it. Like, I've already written the email for you. We just send you the email and you send it to the executives that we, you know, we provide you with that contact information. And when these executives see, you know, hundreds of emails coming in, they realize that they're in trouble, that they're being watched, and they are forced to act. And that is why we move, we are able to move so quickly. It's because we empower the public to join us rather than just, you know, this isn't just signing a petition. This isn't asking or, you know, demanding something. We are stepping in and asking businesses to enforce their legal agreements with advertisers. And that is a very different, ballgame.
All right. But before I let you go really quick, there was one more thing I wanted to touch upon. And I hate to do it because you really wrapped it up and gave a really great, what should have been an ending, but there's just one small thing. I promise, just a few more minutes. You mentioned the Human Events and Postmillennial and how basically recently Human Events bought Postmillennial, and it seems like they had to do it because Postmillennial ran out of advertising revenue because there were no more advertisers.
Was
what was that? I'm sorry, you cut
probably
off
got it for like $5. I said it must have been a real bargain, maybe like $5.
Right, yes. Yes. But the thing I want to touch upon is I didn't realize this, but apparently they tried to get around their loss in advertising revenue by launching like some sort of like non-political neutral like sports website or something. What was that? Can you explain this?
Totally. Yeah. I tweeted about this yesterday. So I told you guys already about the Steve Bannon thing and the Weather Nation TV. So what these guys are doing, knowing that they're being watched by us and being blocked by ad exchanges, and knowing how the advertising system works, which is that these brand safety technology companies only scan the website, like only scan the pages for like a certain list of bad words. Like, they know how to play this game, right? Like, they know how to evade these filters and keep getting the money. So they started a website called wocanada.ca, and all the same people who write for the Postmillennial are writing like 7 desserts you can eat in Toronto, like 5 things you shouldn't miss in Montreal. Like,
oh, it's a travel website. Like, oh, I got it mixed up. It's a travel website.
It's a Canadian tourism website, and it is basically a clickbait content farm. It's a content farm. And there's no mention of the Postmillennial anywhere. They don't like disclose that, nothing. But I found in my research when I was looking into these advertising accounts, this is all publicly available information. I saw this account that was owned by the Postmillennial that had the postmillennial.com on it, humanevents.com, and then wocanada.ca. And I'm like, what the, like, what is this? And then I looked at the authors and I'm like, oh my God, they have the same people who write all the racist, homophobic, transphobic stuff on the Postmillennial, also writing 7 things to do, 7 cool hotels in Quebec, you know, like.
Did Andy Ngo have an article about the best place in Canada for a milkshake?
That, you should submit that as a story idea. But yeah, they write these articles, and then, I mean, I don't want to make any other assertions, but I noticed that there were some really high quality advertisers on there who would not want to be on the Postmillennial. So that's what they're doing. They know that website has been blocked. So they have this sort of brand safe arm, and it's sort of insurance for themselves so that they can keep themselves afloat. And so now that we've caught on, and I just want to say that the work that we are doing is like so important, because what advertisers hear all day is that they need to stay away. And like what they heard when, you know, Sleeping Giant started and said, you know, don't, like, do you really want your ads on Breitbart.com? What they heard is consumers don't want to see our ad next to a bad headline or a controversial headline. So all this technology that has been developed over the past like 5 years is just to like scan the page and just to like make sure that there's nothing bad on it. But no one looks at the ownership. No one looks at that level of like where the money is flowing, who gets the money at the end of the day. So it has been exceedingly easy for people like Bannon and the post-millennial to stay in the supply chain because they know, like, they know intimately how this stuff works, and they are able to, like, I told you some of these figures, right? Like, they're able to keep their organizations afloat while not just afloat, they're able to thrive while real news organizations, legitimate news organizations, local news are falling victim to this technology. And there's a whole other side to this about how this technology is simply so shoddy, like so offensively, like poorly done. It doesn't even do the thing that it says it does. So it's really a game that they've figured out how to play. And that we have also studied super hard to ensure that advertisers understand that this is not about adjacency. This is not just about keeping your ad away from the bad headline. It's about ensuring that you cut off the flow to these bad organizations, to these disinformation operations. And that is the sort of... I think that I would say that's one of the most important things that we have done as an organization. We do see marketers starting to understand this. I mean, I think the public, like you and I have probably already always known this, but I don't know, things get translated in all kinds of weird ways in the advertising industry. So it's a slog, but someone has to do it. And we decided to, and it's working. So come join us. Checkmyads.org/branded. Sorry to plug us, but you know, we want you to join us in this fight. And
I was going to ask you to
know how. Okay. Yeah. We want you to know how this stuff works. That is our success metric. We want the public talking about ad tech. We want the public to know what Safegraph is and like Magnite and Sovereign and all these, you know, all these companies. The more we know, the faster we can stop it.
Nandani Jami, co-founder of Check My Ads, thank you so much for joining me. And I want to say, you know, this I'm not, and I don't say this to all my guests because it doesn't always happen for all my guests, but people in the live chat are already asking me to have you back on the show. So, oh, yeah. I mean, people really enjoyed this. I think they learned a lot. Where can people find, you know, you already plugged Check My Ads, which is great. Everyone should go check out checkmyads.org. But where can people find you online if they want to follow you on Twitter or something?
Yes, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm Nan Doodles. I also get into a lot of drama on LinkedIn. So if you want to connect with, yeah, I don't do the Instagram, but I update LinkedIn practically every day.
Whoa. This is news to me. There's someone doing something interesting on LinkedIn.
That's right. I got into some serious drama last week on LinkedIn. But the ad tech CEO that I called out did end up dropping Real America's Voice from his inventory. Just gained a lot along the way.
Wow. You're going to make me actually not just follow you on LinkedIn, but I'm going to have to actually now check LinkedIn.
I have to log into LinkedIn.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry.
I really thought LinkedIn was only good for, you know, those inspirational CEO stories and all those like, oh, you got to hustle stories. But apparently you're bringing a whole new niche to the LinkedIn ballgame here.
LinkedIn is absolutely an underrated like place, a medium for activism, particularly the kind that I do, which is B2B activism.
I think you just opened a whole new door for me. I need to get on LinkedIn now. Thank you. Have a great night, Nandani. This was absolutely great. Thank you for coming on, and I hope to have you back.
Okay. I would love to be back. This has been so much fun.
Take care. Bye. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that was really interesting. I mean, I'm familiar with some of the ad tech stuff. I mean, I cover tech, and also just from, I think you guys know my story, how like in the no phone calls yet. People are already jumping on to the, I called her on the Doomed Live one. Oh, I got lucky. No one interrupted that. I need to be more careful that next time. I'm just going to sign out from the calls. No calls quite yet. Hold on. I got to do some stuff. And then I will log back into the calls. I promise I'll take your call. I see who's calling in. I'll take your call first. Just give me a second. You know, in the late 2000s and early 2010s, I was really into like the startup world. Like I found it really interesting. Just as like a hobby to like, I thought it was really interesting the way the internet was, you know, moving into like Web 2.0 with social media, and a lot of this ad tech stuff was really coming into its own then. And so, you know, I'm sort of familiar with all this stuff, but to hear Nandini talk about it with her activism and her, I mean, I learned some stuff too. Her really deep understanding was really interesting for me. And especially interesting for someone who was learning about and reading about this stuff like 10 some odd years ago. And also interesting that she brought up Tim Pool, because folks, I have my tickets. And I can tell you right now that on Monday, I mean, I don't know if he wants me announcing it yet, but I'm assuming I can. I mean, I have my tickets sent to me by his team. I will be on May 16th, Monday, May 16th, less than a week from today. I will be on the Tim Pool live stream, live in person in his studio. Just in case you were wondering, I want people to tune in. You'll have to watch Tim Pool's stream. I mean, he gets enough viewers, so don't think, like, don't look at this like, oh, I don't want to give him another view. No, he gets a, I mean, this, it's not like it's gonna, you'll be, you know, go in and be in the live chat and speak your mind. You know, this should be good. I'm planning on, you know, doing my thing. I'm really looking forward to it. People are losing it in the I think it's a big opportunity, honestly. There's no doubt Tim Pool has a huge show on YouTube, probably one of the biggest. He's gonna get mad at me for saying this, but right-wing shows on YouTube. Not quite as big as Crowder, but probably maybe the second biggest after Crowder. I have a lot of things. I'm sure he's going to ask me a lot of things. I have quite a few things to bring up to him. You guys know me. I'm a man with the plan. I know, someone who has been covering right-wing politics for a long time. I spoke with him about it, and I told him I was doing it. And, they said, if there's anyone who I'd be okay with going on a show like that, it's you. And I really appreciate that. Because I think there is a level of trust that people have in what my long history of doing this, someone said, you better record your end. I mean, I won't be able to. I'm going to be there in the studio. I'm not going to be able to do anything. If someone would like to record the Tim Pool live stream, please, by all means. Like, if you, I don't think they're going to do anything. I don't think Tim Pool edits his live shows. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't think he does, though. But if anyone would like to record the live stream, like screen record it or whatever, make sure you're grabbing the audio, too. If anyone would like to do that because you're worried about that, please, by all means. It won't be double stream like I do when I'm doing a stream in my usual studio at home. It's not going to be also on the Matt Binder YouTube channel. No, this is going to be all on Tim Pool's channel. His show gets hundreds of thousands, sometimes million or so views each episode. It wasn't Sam Cedar, David, who said that to me. Tim doesn't edit his live show, says David. Like, listen, I'm okay with, I think he's going to have me on. I think it's actually going to be, I mean, I've seen his debate with Vosh, his debate with Destiny. Destiny's not quite me, or, you know, Vosh is probably close, but I'm going to be going about it much different than Vosh. Actually, maybe not. I mean, stylistically wise, yes, but I think Vosh had a similar goal that I do. I mean, I don't know what his goal is from his mouth, but from watching his debate with Tim on Tim when he was on Tim's show, I think he had a clear goal, and that's sort of going to be mine too. Grim says, just hit record on your phone so you have your own evidence. No, I'm not going to do anything like that. No, no, no. Listen, I'm going to be completely respectful when I'm there. I don't want them to worry. I'm going there like I would to any other show, whether I'm going to be on, and they don't have to worry about anything like that. There's going to be no secret recording. Is there anything like that? I'm going to go. I'm going to say hello. I'm going to be cordial while I'm there. This is his home, I believe, right? It's his, if not his home, it's his personal studio. I'm not gonna, like, so they shouldn't worry about anything like that. If they are, that's silly. I'm gonna go. I'm gonna, just, you know, it's gonna be an opportunity to reach his audience. And, you know, we'll see is his, how much of his audience is just straight up right wingers and how much of his audience is who he, you know, he believes it is, or I don't think he believes it is, but how he portrays them as just like, you know, independent-minded thinkers who aren't left or right. I don't believe that for a second. I mean, I'm sure there are some, which is why I'm going on, but I don't believe it's the vast majority or even close. So, yeah, I think it's going to be a fun time. Good times. And, you know, I think there'll be some interesting moments. Again, I want to make it clear, just in case, if I mean interesting moments, I'm not planning anything. I'm just saying, usually I have, with my own natural charisma and personality and way of talking with people, I have a knack, a habit of getting people to be very open and go places they don't want to necessarily go. Like, for example, that time I just unplanned, just the way the conversation went, and I got him to admit it without even pressing him on it. That time Michael Tracy said that he didn't think it was important to get any sourcing for stories, which blew my mind. Really, it still does to this day, and I still can't believe he openly said it while talking to me. It's baffling to me, quite honest, that he said it and didn't realize what he said, quite frankly. Yeah, I mean, that'll be, that's something, I mean, I don't know exactly what, but I'm sure there'll be something like that because of who I am. I'm looking forward to it. And maybe he'll get me. I don't know. Who knows? Who knows? Maybe he'll get me, and maybe this will all backfire. And I'll be sitting there with milkshake in my face a la Andy No. Yeah, but no, listen, it's gonna be a conversation. I'm not going for any owns or anything like that. I'm looking forward to having a conversation with one of the largest political commentators on YouTube. And you know my feeling all around. I appreciate when someone on the other side actually opens up for this, because it gives their audience an opportunity to listen to something they won't usually listen to on their own. And no matter what else I think about his politics and his rhetoric for everything else, just doing that puts him in a category of my own where you get a little nod from me. You get a little added recognition like Michael Tracy did. Like any of the libertarian callers who call into the Majority Report do. You know, the Convo Couch guys had a debate with me. Last I heard, I'll be doing a debate with some other right-wing or reactionary commentators. I don't remember who, but I'll be doing it with the Lance of the Serfs. That's still in the works, so I can't give you any more details, but there'll be something coming up at the end of May. Yeah, it'll be it'll be a good time, an opportunity. Who knows? Maybe he'll have me back. Even maybe he'll think, this Matt Binder guy. It was because I think at the end of the day, a show as big as his wants someone on who entertains his audience, and I think it'll be good. I think they'll be, let's put it this way, they'll be very entertained. Let's put it that way. Cool. Folks, patreon.com/MattBender to support this show. This may be your last chance to get in the early days. Who knows? After Monday, I might be big time. Who knows, you know? This might be the last opportunity to say I knew Matt Bender before he blew up. I have no expectations of that, honestly. But who knows? Maybe. Maybe it'll surprise me. I'm actually sort of surprised sometimes. I think I mentioned this on the patron-only portion of the show a couple of weeks ago. When Ben Burgess went on Joe Rogan's show, I was really shocked, actually, at how little bump a left-leaning, in the general sense, personality got from going on Rogan's show when compared to, like, when he has literally anyone else on. Like, when Burgess announced he was going on Rogan's show, I was like, oh, my God. Burgess is going to blow up now. It's going to be big for him. Huge. Like, he's going to be – I didn't think he was going to be as big as, like, his right-wing guests when they go on Rogan's show, but I thought he was going to get a nice-sized bump. And from what I've seen, maybe there's data I missed out on. Maybe there's some other monetization, but his patron and his Twitter follower count. I mean, maybe there was a small gain, but it was much lower than you would think Rogan's show going. And I'm not knocking. I don't want anyone to come across thinking I'm knocking Ben Burgess. This is just factual, straightforward information. Like, if any left winger went on, if I went on Rogan's show, I would expect some sort of bump. And I don't think there was. Got a super chat that someone wants me to read. Will T with a $10 super chat says, please give Tim Pool a Stone Cold Stunner in the marketplace of ideas. I will absolutely give Tim Pool a Stone Cold Stunner in the marketplace of ideas. I want to be, it'll be in the marketplace of ideas. There'll be no actual physical contact. patreon.com/MattBender to support this show. You could find the podcast version of the show at doomedcast.com. As always, youtube.com/MattBender. Subscribe to the channel. Twitch.tv/MattBender. Follow the channel on there too. But also, if you are an Amazon Prime subscriber, you get a free Twitch Prime subscription every month. That means if you're an Amazon Prime subscriber, you get a free paid Twitch subscription to give to your favorite streamer every month. Literally, no extra cost to you. Amazon pays the Twitch streamer of your choice once a month. Just connect your Amazon Prime account to your Twitch account and subscribe to my channel using the Twitch Prime subscription that Amazon gives you for free every month. Reminder, if you've already done so or are planning on doing so, the subscriptions do not auto-renew. The free Prime subscriptions, I should be specific, do not auto-renew. If you want to give me your free Twitch Prime subscription every month, you need to manually resubscribe when your prior month subscription lapses. You just do it the same exact way, twitch.tv/MattBender, subscribe via Twitch Prime. It'll even keep track of how long you've been a Twitch Prime subscriber for. It'll tell you, oh, you've resubscribed for 2 months, 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, but you need to manually do it every month. Just be aware of that. Obviously, if you want to give your Twitch Prime subscription to another streamer every now and then, you would not do that to me. But, it sounded like I was saying, don't do that to me. No, I mean, you would not resubscribe to me. But if you do want to give it to me, then you need to resubscribe manually every month. But also, please don't do that to me. Give me your subscription every month. Scam Economy, scameconomy.com. It's also on the YouTube channel, and definitely check out Scam Economy. Molly White was my guest last week. Molly White was also supposed to return to the show this week, And I have interviewed her for the topic we were going to talk about this week. But due to various changes in the crypto market, which some of you might be aware of, which to summarize as crypto line goes down big time, the Molly White interview planned for this week will be aired next week. And I will have an interview this week with someone brand new who will be joining me to talk about something very interesting that happened in the crypto world this week. A very specific event with a certain stablecoin that was supposed to be pegged to the US dollar that I can tell you is now not so much pegged to the US dollar. Unless the US dollar is worth like 70 cents now. Follow me on Twitter at Matt Binder. Oh, Apple Podcasts, Spotify. Go to the Doomed Show. Doomed Show, what am I saying? I mean, it is the Doomed Show, but go to Doomed on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Leave a review, it helps big time. Do the same for Scam Economy. It's like literally super simple. Just open up the Apple Podcast app on your phone. Search Doomed. When you get there, you just got to scroll to where you see the stars and the review aggregate. I think Doomed has a 4.7 out of 5. Scam Economy has a 4.9 out of 5. Leave a review. If you don't want to leave a written review, that's cool. Press the stars. It's super simple to do, really. Just if you can, take a second. Especially if you cannot monetarily support the show, this is a huge help as well. And always, of course, tell your friends, your family members, share the show on Twitter, Facebook, wherever you're on social media, tell your friends about it in person, offline. Please do that. Let people know about the show. Either of them, both of them, whichever one tickles your fancy. All right, folks, let's go to the Patreon half of the show right now. If you're a patron subscriber or a live stream viewer, even if you're just a free live stream viewer, you can stick around. I'm not going to cut you out. You can even call into the show, open up Skype and search Doomed Live. I'll be taking calls. If you're just a lowly free audio listener, then this is where I say to you, I will see you all next time on Doomed.